You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestall. A journey around some of Scotland's hidden haunts is on our itinerary today. As author and the creator of the Eerie Edinburgh YouTube channel, W.G. Gilbert, joins me today. From the infamous cases of Major Thomas Weir and Deacon Brodie, to perhaps the most forgotten haunted house in Scotland, today you'll learn about some of Scotland's strangest spirits. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patrons, Paul, Danny Boy, Liam, and Andrew, and to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your contributions. It is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes and news, and our exclusive merchandise site is available through TeePublic, and the link for that is in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, to one of the most beautiful countries in the world, where strange things can lurk in the shadows. Scotland is known as a paranormal hotspot around the world, with some notorious and infamous ghosts. Yet there are far more that many people are aware of, and in his brilliant new book, Hidden Haunts Scotland, author W.J. Gilbert introduces us to several overlooked events and incidents. Mr. Gilbert, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm delighted to have you join me.
Thank you, Paul. It's a genuine pleasure to be on the show. Hey. I've followed you a long time, and this is kind of the gold standard for me, so it's a pleasure.
Oh, well, it's lovely to be held in such regard as someone who's released a brilliant book and has a fabulous YouTube channel as yourself, Wayne. So thank you. This is a mutual pat on the back for us both then. As I was saying, Scotland, as I'm sure you're aware, is a place I'm very fond of. I've been very fortunate to visit most of the major haunted hotspots in the area. I've sailed on Loch Ness. I've visited the castle from Highlander. I really enjoy it. I've had one of the strangest experiences of my life at Glencoe, which I've never been able to put my finger on what occurred that night. It's a place I have a lot of time for, both its history and its modern place in the world, Wayne. For someone as immersed in the paranormal as you are these days with your book and your YouTube channel, would you say that Scotland is one of those countries where the populace are very comfortable with the paranormal?
Yeah, I think so. Being from Edinburgh, nicknamed the City of the Dead, we're surrounded by stories and ghost tours and legends and history. So I kind of grew up knowing a lot about the Edinburgh side of things. And as I've grown older and my interest has spread beyond the boundaries of the city, I've started to understand and find out more about everything else that's gone on, and the folklore beyond Edinburgh is just as fascinating as the ghost lore within Edinburgh.
Mm.
And that's really what's kept my interest. You know, there's only so many times you can tell the same stories about like the vaults and Greyfriars and things like that, and to go beyond that and find out the history of places like Balleken House, Ardvark Castle up in Sutherland, through some of the stories through in Glasgow and Inverness and places like that. Everywhere, you know, beyond the bubble of Edinburgh, everywhere in Scotland is comfortable and are really starting to talk more about the folklore and the haunted history side of things and the mystery aspect to it. So you kind of grow up with the stories and with the legends. And it's nice to see it sort of mature beyond it being like a tourist industry to that kind of embracing of the culture, if that makes sense. It's really nice to see.
Do you think how Scotland has shaped itself over the last sort of 30 or 40 years, Wayne, has enabled the populace to try and reclaim their folklore and their past and their history? Because as with Wales and Ireland, there are aspects of history where things have been suppressed. People have been murdered for going to the wrong church. People have been told that they must speak English and not Gaelic or Welsh. And so I think as the country seems to have found its footing and begun to stand on its own two feet, the same with Wales over the last very similar period as well, it seems that whilst the Scottish have always been very proud of their home country, I think now they're shouting a little bit more about the things that were perhaps frowned upon in the olden ways. And now we're getting a country that seems very comfortable in showing off some of its incredible folklore. I mean, the Kelpie statues that have been built recently are just incredible pieces of art, as well as being quite iconic, I think. And I think that alone, for me, kind of puts a full stop on Scotland's found itself again.
Hmm. Yeah, it's funny you say that. I remember growing up, and I've lived in Edinburgh practically all my life. It was my mum and my sister and I. She was a single parent, and we lived in a housing estate in Edinburgh. So I had quite a working class Edinburgh accent, and I remember always getting a clip round the ear saying, "You can't," you know, I would run around saying, "I didn't care what you're talking about, man."
Kind of yeah.
You'll never get a job if you speak like that. So my Scottishness was suppressed, and I had to speak Queen's English, that kind of thing. That's why I probably now have. If you're Scottish, I'd probably sound quite posh to some areas. When I'm not, I am working class Edinburgh accent, really.
Yeah.
So there was that, I don't know if embarrassment is the right word, but suppression, as you said, where you kind of had to be North British rather than Scottish. And over the past few years, like you say, that's really changed. I think the example that you gave, the statues of the Kelpies, is a perfect example. You only have to go back to the 90s, was it, or the early noughties, where there was the films about the Kelpies and they're portrayed as like playful water horses, Disneyfied. But the reality of a Kelpie is quite horrific. You know, they would appear as a really enticing looking horse. When you saw it, you felt you had to run up and jump on its back and go for a ride. But what it would do was it would drag you under the water and it would eat your intestines and leave you there, which is a world away from the portrayal that you see in Disney. So we are rediscovering the true folklore rather than the quaint folklore, you know, the Greyfriars Bobby type folklore, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And it's been embraced and spoken about a lot more. And I think that's a lot to do with things like the popularity of the North Coast 500. It's bringing lots of people over here to the chagrin of the locals at times. But you get a real sense of areas of Scotland where you wouldn't normally, because it's not part of the Central Belt. You know, you're right at the top of the country where there's so many stories, you know, Selkies, Kelpies, Cognacs, which is like the Scottish equivalent of a banshee.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually just got a book coming out called The Ghostly Tales of the North Coast 500, which covers a lot of the stories that are up that way around the route of the North Coast. It's like a guidebook. So working on that kind of really shown me how much history and how much folklore there is in other parts of the country. And how we're now doing more, like with the onset of the internet, we can really spread that information, whereas it wasn't really, you know, you had to go to like Cayley's poor storytelling centres, that kind of thing. But now we've got a proper chance to tell our side of things, tell our history.
I think you only have to look as well at Scotland's archaeological history as well, Wayne, where you've got some incredible monuments and standing stones and circles, some of the bothies that have been built, some of the acoustic power that these ancient buildings have had. And it just shows you that there's quite a lot in it, because I know often people point back to when the Romans were here and they built Hadrian's Wall to keep you out, but I think it was more to stop anybody getting over the getting down, because the Romans were terrified. And I think when you look at that history and the culture and how they utilized their environments and their belief systems and things, and some of these buildings where if you use your voice at the right resonance, it creates this kind of cacophony that sounds almost heavenly to some and hellish to others. There's so much history there that even so in this day and age, I know recently there was that incredible sort of stone circle that's been uncovered off the coast that seems to have fallen into the sea, or just the sea has risen above it, Wayne, and kind of reclaimed it. And you just think, well, how long's that been there? Just sat there waiting for somebody to go, oh, hang on a minute, what the hell's this?
Yeah, I mean, Edinburgh is a good example of that. We think of Edinburgh as a medieval city. It was medieval for a long time, probably longer than most European cities. But there's thousands of years of history here. Castle Rock, where the Edinburgh Castle is, used to have I think it was a Pictish or Celtic hill fort on it, and the Votadini tribe used to control this area. So you're going back more than 2,000 or 3,000 years worth of history built on top of each other. I was down at Dryburgh Abbey earlier on today, and you drive past Sutra Isle, which is an old, it's the Sutra Pass. It's an old building that was part of a monastery. But if you look at it now, it's just farmers' fields. But that was once a thriving community of monks and things. So there's, like you say, there's so much history that we've discovered, and so much that you just don't see because it's not there anymore. And you really have to dig deep into it to understand what we were like as a people. It's crazy that we have so many years, but it's only really certain periods that are thought about, like Mary Queen of Scots, Jacobite rebellions, that kind of things. But there's so much to the country.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's one of those things, you know, speaking as somebody that obviously grew up in the English school system, we would often be told about, like you've just said, you know, we'd touch on, say, Robert the Bruce, Mary Queen of Scots, the Jacobites, and maybe a little bit about a couple of other skirmishes and things, primarily told from our side, obviously. And so as someone that loves history and mysteries and folklore and things, it didn't take me very long to realise that we were getting a very piecemeal part of Scotland's history. But it's interesting because obviously I would imagine there was a lot of influence on the education system north of the border from down here as well. When I say down here, we both know we mean London. We're probably practically clansmen, really, aren't we? Us northerners, we're all pretty much in the same boat, really, Wayne. And so I think we sometimes seem surprised, I think, unless we really know a lot, to think, well, it looks like we were all told the same things and we were given these piecemeal aspects of it. And now I think we can go back and find out, because it seems like history seems to jump 200 years in Scotland for major events. And yet you think, well, these things just didn't pop up. It weren't like waves. It was always there. There was just certain things that seemed to catch the national attention rather than the history of the country.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I remember being in primary school and learning about the Battle of Hastings and the Battle of Stamford Bridge, and learning about Bannockburn. I didn't learn about that until after I left school. The Battle of Stirling Bridge was touched on, but we learned a lot more about English history. And that's not to say that I didn't enjoy that. I love all aspects of history, and England has a fascinating history as well. Mm. But it kind of felt like we were to be taught one way, and there's so much more that goes on. Like you say, you know, there's this whole period where nothing really seems to happen in Scotland. And, you know, if you dig only back 200 or 300 years, Scotland, Edinburgh in particular, was seen as the I can't remember the phrase for it, but the shining light. We were seen as like one of the focal points for the great thinkers. You know, we had the medical breakthroughs and geological and the geology that was being studied in Edinburgh became something that impacted how rocks and the earth was studied across the globe, which doesn't make any sense, but hopefully you understand what I'm trying to say. But it does feel like we haven't in Scotland learned enough. Or when I was at school anyway, I think it's different now. I've got a couple of kids and they talk in depth about some of the stuff that they've learned. Unfortunately, they don't quite have the love for history that I do, but they do seem to learn a lot more about Scotland and the people that we were and that we are than I did when I was at school.
Yeah. Well, I think it still surprises me. And I think the first thing I want to touch on before we dive into some of the incredible stories that you've included in this book, and as you touched on earlier, I think everybody's heard of the Mackenzie poltergeist, and depending on how well you want to research something, the real version or the Hollywood version that seems to be the more popular aspect of it. And as you say, Greyfriars Bobby, even I knew that was nonsense, Wayne, when I turned up, right? But I still touched his nose, just in case. Just in case. Because you never know. But even that blew me away when I went in the graveyard. And you've got those sticks that people leave the sticks at the grave. And I'm thinking, what? I've never seen anything like that in my life. I've been, because obviously I did one of the ghost tours, and so we ended up in the Greyfriars churchyard next door to just round the corner from the statue, and obviously infamous because of the Mackenzie Poult and the mausoleum there. But even that, like I say, even that kind of surprise, little things like that surprise me more than scary stories, because then I think that's when you know something's kind of technically gone above and beyond any version that will pull people back, because people are clearly coming from all around the world who have fallen in love with this story, and most people would suggest that it is, you know, it's one of those tales, but it's still a wonderfully heartwarming story. Yes, it's got a tragedy involved in it, but that even the story of a dog and it pining after its master, even in the 21st century, Wayne, still has that emotional pull on people. And so when I come across a story that's been as well reported and as notorious and has such disturbing elements to it, when I first came across this story, and it's only probably 3 or 4 years ago when I heard about it on Rich McLean Smith's Unexplained, was The Wizard of West Bow. And when I saw the episode title, I thought, well, what's all this about? Is it like Scotland's version of John Dee or something like that? And after about 10 minutes, I quickly rearranged my opinions and I thought, what the hell is going on here? And why have I not heard about Major Thomas Weir before? Because this is the kind of story that blows your mind, because you can't. I know it's like nearly 400 years ago since it all sort of came crashing down around the Major. But still, it's one of those stories where I've had to double check things, even though Richard's such a good researcher and I know he usually gets the vast majority of information correct, as we all try and do, well, most of us. And so I'm stunned by this story. When I came to Edinburgh, it was the first place I visited, Wayne, because I had to go and stand there and think, bloody hell.
Yeah, I love this story. So Thomas Weir later became known as the Wizard of West Bow, but in earlier life, he was known as one of the Bowhead Saints. So the Bowhead is the West Bow area, and the saint is a sobriquet for passionate Calvinists, of which Weir was. Now, he was born, I think it's in 1599, on the west coast of Scotland in the village of Carluke. He was born into a wealthy family. His father was the Laird of Kirkton. His father was quite a notorious character. He was known for treachery. And his mother was said to be a renowned clairvoyant or a sorceress to others. So he had quite a dysfunctional, to use the modern phrase, upbringing. And he had a sister called Grizel. So it was Thomas and Grizel, and they moved to Edinburgh in the 1700s. I think it was around 1649. Now, Thomas had quite a distinguished military career up to that point, and he was a deeply religious man. I think he fought in the Irish Rebellion before joining, if memory serves, the anti-monarchy Scottish army. So that's the kind of character that he was. And being a Bowhead saint, he very, very religious. He used to hold sermons within his property every Sunday. People of stature and wealth would come and listen to him speak. And towards the end of his life, I think he was around 70 or 71, I think, he basically was holding a sermon within his house and he stopped what he was doing and admitted that he was in league with the devil, that he was having an incestuous affair with his sister, Griselle, that he was having his way with animals, that he would be carried to Musselburgh on the outskirts of Edinburgh in a coach that would come thundering through the sky, a flaming coach, and pick him up, and all of these scandalous accusations that he was making about himself, as was the way, probably still is the way, you know, a lot of famous people in Edinburgh at the time, a lot of important people were shocked by this, and the first reaction that they had was they had to cover this up. You know, they couldn't get this out. They thought he'd gone mad, but he was adamant that this was the truth, that he had a walking cane that would walk in front of him when he was walking down the street and all of this sort of stuff. So once he'd admitted to that, he was tortured. He gave up Griselle. She was elderly as well. She admitted to this also. And they were both executed. He was strangled at a place called, I think it's Shrub Hill, and Griselle was burnt at the stake just along the road from where I lived down in Leith. But the thing that always kind of sticks with me is basically his last words were, I've lived as a beast and I must die as a beast. But once he'd been executed, all of these stories used to come out that people would walk past his house and they would see like parties being held with witches and people floating. A 12-foot witch was seen in the close that his house was situated on. And to this day, his sister's face, Griselle, is seen in the grass market area of Edinburgh. She appears in windows and her face is on fire. So, you know, there's all these stories that came out after he admitted to what was happening. But the really interesting thing is his house was thought to be lost. They thought it had been knocked down when they redeveloped like Victoria Street and areas of the grass market. But it was rediscovered, a section of the house was rediscovered in what's known as the Quaker's House, I think in the 1990s or the noughties. And that the building that is now there is notorious for ghost sightings, and it's a tall person, probably from the 17th century, that walks about the building. So he seems to still be lingering, and his sister as well still lingers about too.
I think the thing that's always struck me about it, Wayne, is how he got to this point in his life where he just decided to confess. Because as you say, he was held in such high regard, and people feared him as well as admired him. He had a fearsome reputation. I know he used to say some very nasty things about Anglicans, amongst other things. But there'd always been these strange rumours about him in the past. I know there was allegedly one woman who claimed to have seen him fornicating with a cow, I believe it was, who was lashed through the streets of Edinburgh for lying, which one can only wonder how she felt if she was still with us at the point where we're confessed his crimes. And I know people just seem to be very stuck on why he went, because I know at the time they were trying to say that he'd lost control of his mental faculties, or perhaps he, as we would consider in this day and age, perhaps he had Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or something, and he was suffering from some kind of mental deterioration. But he was steadfast in it. And I believe the doctors said the only thing he's suffering from is a guilty conscience.
Yeah, the incident you talked about, I think, was when he lived out Carluke out on the west coast, and he was a younger man. So there is that history of violence with him. And like I said, his father was quite a character, quite a treacherous character who did what he could to get his own way and earn riches from it. So he clearly has some tendencies, you know, sociopathic or psychotic. I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't diagnose, but there's a history there with them. To admit to some of this stuff, there has to be, you know, unless there are two possibilities. He did have a mental illness, or he was telling the truth. And if he's telling the truth, then that's quite a scary prospect.
Yes. You
know, a horse and cart driven by the devil basically would come and collect him. But there's obviously some truth to it. There was a lot of stories came out that instead of sermons at times, he would entertain the wives of some of the local people. So he clearly had an eye for the ladies, shall we say. you know, like you say, he was adamant that this is the life that he led, and he deserved to be punished for it, which is why the "I've lived as a beast, I'll die as a beast" statement was made by him. But there have to be some things to it that are either completely true and scary, or he suffered from some sort of mental illness, which probably through a modern lens, like you say, would be Alzheimer's or something like that.
Mm.
And Grizel as well corroborated his stories too.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. This is the strange thing. You know, fair enough. If he's not very well, fine. But if your sister's saying everything's true, and then I think he had another sister called Margaret, and she said, "Oh, well, I actually caught them in bed once," and just didn't think anything of it. And you're like, right, okay, I think we just need to shut the door on this family. They're all a bit strange. But it's surprising, because I know, I don't know, early 19th century, one of Scotland's greatest authors, Sir Walter Scott, one of the aspects of his writing I find quite interesting, Wayne, is he gets overlooked because he had in regards to the work he did in regards to the supernatural and folklore, everybody sort of remembers him for his great novels, such as Ivanhoe. But you've got a learned man who was deeply interested in these aspects of it, who wrote about Weir at that period. And yet here we are 200 years later, and it seems as though it's only been rediscovered again in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. For the hardcore Edinburgh ghost lovers, we've always known about Major Weir, but it's been one of these stories that is, you have to know it to know it, if that makes sense. It's not one that's advertised for exactly the reasons that we've talked about. How do you bring the tourists in to learn about sodomy or bestiality and incestuous relationships? That's not the kind of thing like a Mackenzie Poltergeist, where you've got a creepy looking mausoleum and you've got one person who can be your demon, for want of a better word. This is something far, far darker than that. So it's really difficult to market. So, you know, I've known about that story since I was a boy. I didn't realise some of the aspects of it until I was a wee bit older. Thankfully, I don't think my brain would have been able to cope with that. But and since the 90s, these stories just get overlooked for the likes of the vaults. You know, whenever the vaults were discovered, that's just taken the zeitgeist for Edinburgh. Mary King's Close. And then the incidents in Greyfriars Kirk as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It is, like you say, surprising. I think the one thing that made me chuckle when I went there is that there's a Harry Potter shop on West Bow, which I think if you're gonna build a shop celebrating probably the most famous wizard in the world, where else would you have it?
Yeah, good point. I never actually thought about that connection, but that's a good point.
Yeah, that's the way my weird brain works, Wayne. I mean, obviously, one of the great things about this book is, like you say, you dance around the Edinburgh's big hitters and then take us further afield. I mean, there's a couple that I was aware of, and the first one I want to touch on is Chessel Court, because I was aware of this. And so when I came up and I did the vault tour and everything and saw the sights as you can down there if you're stuck in the dark. But this was also one of the places I really wanted to visit, because this is a really interesting location as well in the city.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of history. It's not the oldest close in the city. I think it's 16th century. It was built, or 17th. But it's the site of the old ex-customs and excise building, and it's got links to Dr. Jekyll and Hyde. You probably are aware of the character Deacon Brodie.
Yes.
Yeah, so Deacon Brodie was another one like Major Weir. He was like a stand-up Edinburgh citizen. He was the... Let me think, what was he again? He was the locksmith, one of the main locksmiths in Edinburgh. Edinburgh in that time was really small. If you've ever been, it was basically the Royal Mile, which is an old Scots mile. It's not very wide. It's like a fishbone with all these different closes, these narrow streets leading off the main street. And there was about 60,000 people that were crammed into that in the 16th, 17th and 18th century. If the story is right, we were the first place to build skyscrapers. Some of the tenements were 14 stories high, 7 stories in stone. The other 7 stories would be made of wood. So that's where the poor people would live, because you can't light a fire in a wooden structure. So he was a locksmith. He was also head of the town council by day, and at night he lived the second life. He was another person who had a love for extracurricular activities. He had quite an extravagant lifestyle. He drank excessively, he gambled, he had mistresses, he had umpteen illegitimate children, and he had to fund that. So he came upon the idea of, he was the locksmith. He cuts keys for everybody. He cuts keys for the rich people. If he cuts the key, leaves it a few weeks, then he's got access to that person's property. If you leave it a few weeks, then the attention won't be on you. That was his thinking. And he made quite a successful life out of that. And that was until they decided they were going to rob the customs and excise house in Chessel's court. So he was the leader of a gang of robbers. And they planned this raid on the excise office in Chessel's court. But the problem was an employee returned to work during the raid and disturbed them. They managed to escape. Most of them got caught, but Brody managed to go on the run. He escaped by ship from Leith and tried to head to Amsterdam to avoid capture. Tried to bribe the ship's captain to divert the ship and all of that sort of stuff, but he ended up having to come back to Edinburgh, and he was captured and hung in front of a crowd of about 40,000 people. So that's kind of the proven history of Chessel's court, but it's also got a really interesting haunting to it. And it's known as the Lady in Black of Chessel's Court. And I've got a friend who's got a connection to it as well. So it was in the 1740s, I think. But there was a woman who lived in Chessel's Court called Mrs. Gordon. And she lived on her own. And she lived in she was quite a well-to-do woman. It's quite a nice area. So the houses were quite large. And she lived on her own. She did have a brother who would come and stay with her on occasion. But the ghosts... The haunting started basically one night, and it's kind of one of these things that just starts really small, really innocuous. She heard somebody coming up the stairs to her door, expected a knock on the door. Nothing happened. That happened a few times after, and she managed to get to the door. Before she would open it, she would hear really heavy breathing outside. And if you've ever been to Edinburgh, everywhere is uphill. So you know, it's not unusual for us to be out of breath whenever we're walking. But she would get to the door, open the door, and there's nobody there. You know, she'd step outside with a lantern in her hand, trying to see if she could see people running away. Never found anybody, never heard anything. And just assumed that this was something unusual that was going on. So that happened on a regular basis. And then Mrs. Gordon's brother came to stay for the night. They sat up. They talked. She didn't really want to tell him about the things that had been happening, so she didn't. He retired to go to sleep in the guest room, and he woke up in the middle of the night to see a woman in a black dress walking out of an alcove across the room and through a wall. And he basically just, that's enough. I'm out of here. So he apparently never came back. I think that's the only recorded time that she's been spotted. But there was somebody in the 80s that lived in Chessel's Court as well. And he had quite an insidious encounter where he woke up in the middle of the night. He could hear breathing. And it's this kind of that really classic old hag where he could feel somebody lying on top of him, and he could hear the breathing as well. But also, I've got a friend called Jonathan Tallon, who he's got a YouTube channel, and he runs ghost tours in the area called North Edinburgh Nightmares. And he stayed in Chessel's Court before he was going to a gig at the Usher Hall. And they'd ordered pizza, and they heard footsteps coming up the stairs. So they opened the door expecting to see the pizza delivery guy, and nobody appeared. The stairwell was empty, but both he and his girlfriend at the time had both heard footsteps coming up the stairs. I believe that happened on a couple of other occasions as well. So that kind of, like, I know John. I know he does do ghost tours, but he's a very genuine guy. He doesn't embellish stuff. And that just kind of really brings it home that there's something going on in Chessel's Court.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
It's remarkable, really. And like you say, I think the area is full of these wonderful sort of glimpses back into the past where even now, as you say, even as in a city that's been as redeveloped as well, Wayne, as Edinburgh has over the last 100-150 years, it's peculiar in some aspects just how connected the past seems to be with the present near enough every turn you take when you're walking around Edinburgh.
Yeah, my favourite story from the Royal Mile in Edinburgh is Queensbury House. Mm. And that has the past and the present. The irony of it was owned by the Marquess of Queensbury, who was a key figure in the Act of Union in 1707. He was one of the people that really drove for that to happen, which was really popular with the landed gentry at the time, but really unpopular with the ordinary everyday people. So when that happened, there was either riots or celebrations, depending on which class you were at the time. And the irony of it is now it's one of the buildings used in the Scottish Parliament. I think it's where the secretaries are based. So it's gone from being a pusher of creating the union to this independent Scottish government now. But that's got an incredible history to it. So the Marquess had a son. This is kind of similar to the stories of Glamis Castle, if you know those stories. The son at the time was considered, and I'll use the language that they used, was an idiot. And he was a violent idiot, so he had to be locked up for his own good and for the good of the people around him. When the Act of Union was signed, the Marquess and his family left to go to a celebration. The official story is it's a street party, but I don't think that would have been the case in Edinburgh at that time, because it was really unpopular. So they left, and they left the house in the care of the kitchen boy, and the son was left locked up in his room in the basement. When the family returned, when the Marquess returned, they came through, they walked through the door, had this lovely sweet aroma, thinking the kitchen boy has cooked us, knew we were coming back, has cooked us a dinner. They walked into the kitchen and they found their son had escaped and had murdered the kitchen boy and was roasting him in the fire. Which, as a kid growing up, that's just the perfect story to catch your imagination. And it wasn't until maybe 10, 15 years ago that I found out that it's actually haunted as well. And the stories I can't find, and this is one of the reasons that I really wanted to feature this in the book. But after it stopped being a townhouse, it was used as many different things. I think during World War One, it was used as like a hospital. It became a care home for elderly people from the 60s through maybe to the 90s. And I remember reading somewhere about the experience that the nurses had in the property. And they would tell stories about they were slapped and violently attacked. And the one that sticks out was that one of them was pinned against the wall by a black shadow. I can't find record of that anywhere. I definitely read it, but there's nowhere around that. So I kind of wanted to feature that in the book, so it's in print and it's going to be around for as long as the book is in print. But also the kitchen boy is said to be seen in what was the kitchen, but is now the bar of the Scottish Parliament, and the fireplace is not in use, but it's still a feature in the bar. If you go online, you can see pictures of the fireplace, big, huge stone fireplace, as you would expect from a 17th century townhouse.
Yeah.
But it's a cracking story, and to find it's haunted as well just gives it that wee extra edge.
Well, to be fair, Wayne, I'd be more surprised that it wasn't haunted based on the events that happened, because, I mean, this is one of the things I think that's quite surprising about Edinburgh, that you've got these extremely bloody crimes throughout the period of around 100 years. Obviously, we've got this and the fact of the establishment cover-up. I mean, I think that James passed away quite young anyway, didn't he? Because he was clearly very ill for whatever reason. But, I mean, I'm laughing because I'm frightened, I think. I mean, to be caught cooking and eating a member of staff is quite terrifying. And You would imagine something like that must imprint itself, if we are to believe in things like the stone tape theory or the very essence of that particular building, because it's still with us. And when you look at something, as we mentioned, Thomas Weir, and then you've also got Burke and Hare, there are some notable cases in Edinburgh, which I think kind of propel some of these historical events to different levels, because there's, you know, as I said, Weir, the story about Queensbury House and James, the son, and Burke and Hare, these are all factual events. That there's no flim-flam here at all, Wayne. These are shockingly abhorrent crimes of a variety of natures that are well reported. And the one thing that seems to connect them as well is, and you were referring to some of the educational and archaeological advances that have come through Edinburgh over the years, and you look at the history of medicine in the city and the advancements that was done due to the dissection of bodies and the works that were going on there with the surgeons and the schools, that there's a lot of establishment fingers in these cases that seem to get pulled away, and they kind of just leave the miscreants to deal with the ramifications, because obviously Burke and Hare famously were taken to trial. One was hung and one was not, but nobody in the medical establishment was tried or anything. And at the end the reason that Burke and Hare were doing what they're doing was because they were being paid by people who knew exactly where these bodies were coming from.
Exactly. You know, you mentioned there James, the son who killed the kid. He was basically just whisked away and kept. I think he was moved down to England. He did inherit titles. He never inherited the Marquis because of what he'd done. But that's the punishment for him. He just didn't get elevated to the level that his father had been. You mentioned Dr. Knox there. Yeah. Dr. Knox lived in a street called Blackett Place, which is a fantastic haunting on it. He escaped. There was a mob outside his house baying for blood. You know, the ordinary people wanted to take justice, the law into their own hands. But he escaped dressed as a Highlander. He was never brought to trial, but Burke and Hare were. Like you say, it was, you know, if you had the money, you got away with it.
Yeah. And it's not, this is not a modern thing. I mean, often people think that this is something that happens in the modern era. It's always gone on, regardless that we've always had this two-tier. There's the likes of us, Wayne, and then there's the ones above us who control everything in whichever realm, be it political or royalty or religious sects. They always have, they're always above us, regardless. And we can't seem to reach up to pull them down to our level to receive the justice that they all deserve, to be fair.
Yeah, we do try at times, but never quite happens.
I mean, it does seem sometimes that you basically can walk out of one street onto another, and it's almost as if you're walking away from one ghost and straight into the embrace of another one. Do you think that that's one of the great things about Edinburgh? Because for me, in Britain, Edinburgh and York, for me, are shoulder to shoulder in regards to their haunted histories, and the fact that both have really embraced both their tumultuous histories as well as their supernatural grip on us. And so it's, for me, it's one of those places where you can just, every step, you feel like you're walking through the past, Wayne. And even for somebody who's a, you know, near enough a lifelong resident, does it still seem as fresh and exciting for someone as well versed with its haunted history as yourself?
It does, yeah. So I live in Leith, near the shore in Leith, and at the bottom of my street is a 16th century cemetery.
Yeah.
Lived here. My neighbour down below me has lived here all her life, and I got chatting to her, and she used to tell me stories of when she was a kid, that before they built the Water of Leith walkway, the graveyard went down to the river. And when the river flooded, the bones would get washed out. So they'd go and collect the bones, and she'd hide them under her mum's bed, and they'd play football with skulls in the street. And that just kind of blew my mind. And then I went on, the guy I mentioned earlier, John, he does a ghost tour around this area. I don't know. I'm starting to learn more about it through the likes of John and through some of the other local storytellers. The history of Leith was brand new to me. You know, we were bombed by the American Navy in the 18th century, which meant that we had to build a fort to protect ourselves against the Americans, which blew my mind. There's a ghost story. You know, I can look out my window on the Leith Library, and there's a story of the ghost is He was known as the Catman, who had been drinking in a pub in the 90s. He'd met a man from Aberdeen. They'd got himself what we'd call a carryout. So they'd gone to the shops to buy some booze to go drinking back in his flat. It turns out the man from Aberdeen killed him. He was going to go to trial, but some of the witnesses that they brought up for the prosecution testified that they'd seen the man after the pathologist and things, the forensics had said that the guy was dead. But they were like, nope, I saw him. I walked past him in the stairwell. So this is a ghost story that genuinely, like you say, this is a real event. It delayed the murder trial because these people, I think it was three people, had seen this man after he'd been killed.
Hmm.
And I had no idea about this story. I didn't know about the story at the time. I think the late 90s. And so to hear these things and to know that, you know, there's the Trinity Poltergeist, which is about a half mile away down the road from me, and all of these other stories around me, there's so much more to find out about Edinburgh than I ever thought I knew.
It is surprising sometimes when you speak to people. I mean, in my real job, I work for the Royal Mail. And I think it was about, must have been last summer, I think, we had one of our posties ring up from Sorky in Scotland, and he lived on Park Crescent. And so I said to him, oh, so you live on the famous haunted street then? And he went, yeah, and it's still haunted now. And so we ended up having a 10-minute conversation about all his relatives and friends on the street, apart from who all knew about the Campbell story, and said, yeah, everybody on the street has strange experiences, and they're still going on now. And I mentioned this to Malcolm Robinson about it, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, I've spoke to loads of people, but nobody wants to come forward and go into print about it. But everybody says the street's haunted, not just that particular house, which I thought, what?
Yeah, I work with a girl who's from Alloa and who also spent time in Sauchie. And they would avoid that street when they were driving past. So there's still something going on there. It's a fascinating account.
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh, absolutely. It's an incredible case. If we could only find that lost BBC footage, Wayne.
Mm.
As always the case with some of these things, it's so tantalising. But I think one of the other great aspects of your book is that, yes, we talk about some of the lost or perhaps overlooked cases from Edinburgh and the surrounding areas near enough, but you've also got this wonderful part three where you're talking about some other hauntings across Scotland, and there's a wonderful paragraph at the beginning of it that says, my love for a good ghost story is almost eclipsed by my passion and enthusiasm for exploring this truly magnificent country. My friends often joke that Visit Scotland should sponsor me, as I speak so highly and with such enthusiasm about the land of my birth. And I can only concur with that. Whilst I'm probably nowhere near as well travelled in the glens and woods of the area, whenever I've been in there, and like I said, my first visit, we basically did a touring car trip for 2 weeks and just drove around, stopped at a B&B and just drove all the way up to Inverness and back down. And so we just stopped in some really wonderful places, and that we were blessed with the weather, Wayne, and I can remember coming down the west coast of Scotland on a beautiful summer's day. The sun was shining, and we were just looking across, and it was to die for. It was almost as if I was having a glimpse of heaven if it was covered in heather. You know, it was absolutely glorious, and I just thought, this, when you've got the weather like this, it's like where I live, when you go out into the Peaks or onto the Pennines on a beautiful day, it makes you just feel really alive, if that makes sense, because it's phenomenal. And then when you've got some of the wonderful places and vistas in Scotland that you guys have, I can only imagine what it's like to really get tramping out there on occasions.
Yeah, Scotland in the sunshine is just like you talked about the west coast there. If you go up to the northwest, some of the beaches like Camasdaric Beach near Arisaig, Achmelvik and Clashtoll,
yeah,
right up north. If you didn't put your feet in the water, you would think you were in the Bahamas.
Yes.
You know, until you put your feet in the water and it feels like you've got an ice cream headache in your feet, you wouldn't know any different.
Yes.
But we have that aspect where the sun is out, everything is glorious. But it's one of these strange countries as well that when it's miserable, when it's dark and gloomy, it brings out that other aspect of it, that mystical aspect to it. So, you know, Billy Connolly's famously said, you know, there's no such thing as bad weather, there's just the wrong clothes. And he's absolutely right. I used to tell my kids, I've never gone for a walk in the woods and come out in a bad mood. And it's true. Anywhere you go in Scotland, it's surprising. You know, I For a wee while, I lived out in West Lothian, and I thought West Lothian is just industrial and there's not much to it, but there's such amazing walks there and, you know, glens and things like that. You just have to look for it and be adventurous. But Scotland as a country, I just absolutely love. I'm so used to going to places like Pitlochry and Blairathal in Perth, right in the centre of Scotland, which is big tree country. And that's picture postcard Scotland. You know, that's where Schiehallion is, Loch Tay, you know, Ben Lawers, places like that. But when you venture out, and being an East Coaster, I always thought that the East Coast is better than the West Coast. And I was very, very wrong when I went out to the West Coast. My first realization that this is a special country was in 2006 when my ex-wife and I went to a place called Gia. And I remember driving through near Arica, probably up the A82 along the Rest and Be Thankful. And even though I was driving, I was like in awe at the mountains that I was driving under. And that's when I really started to feel connected to the country out with Perth and Edinburgh, and just had that, I have to explore this more. And being a young dad, I didn't cope very well being I was a teenager until I was about 32 in my head.
Yes.
So I needed to find something that didn't involve me going to the pub, and I started to go hill walking. I tried the usual, you know, Munro bagging, which is great. I really, really enjoy it until I rediscovered that I have a terrible fear of heights.
Yes.
And being 3,000 feet up a mountain doesn't help with that.
No.
So I'd start to go around like the glens and the longer distance walks, and I'd be passing places like what's the walk that I do? I can't remember the name of it, but it's near Dunkeld. And I remember reading the map after I'd done the walk, and there's like Robert the Bruce's cave and all of these things that I'd walked past that I had no idea they were there. And that's when I started to really, really read up on the area and the land that I was a part of. And just really fell in love with it more so than I had been. It's such a wonderful country.
It is surprising, I think, sometimes when you discover things like that. I've always enjoyed getting out, and living in Sheffield, I'm quite spoiled because everything's fairly close. So I walk most places. If I can, you know, I walk to work, I walk from work, I walk into the city centre, I'll walk into some of the suburbs and do some bits and bats. I'm very fortunate in that kind of regard. And I think when you start spreading your wings a bit further and appreciating things that are a little bit further out, you suddenly realise just how fortunate we are when we live in such places, I think. But then on top of that, like you say, you suddenly realise that you're walking through history, or you're walking past places and where certain events have happened that have of massive historical significance, that if you hadn't started walking there and looking for routes, then you'd just be oblivious to it all. And then I would imagine, as you've developed it and got the route and it becomes one of your favourite sort of spots to stretch your legs and clear the mind, I would imagine you then get sort of laser focused on where certain things are and trying to find these locations to give it even more depth and clarity.
Yeah, I mentioned Pitlochry and Blairathal earlier on, and there's so much history there. I first went up to Pitlochry in 1984, so I think I was 9 at the time. My mum bought a book called Scottish Ghosts that I've still got the copy, and it had a story called The Death Bogle of Pitlochry. So that took my attention. The Death Bogle is like a banshee. If you see it, you're supposed to die.
Yes.
So I was always terrified. What if it was seen at a crossroads? And I was like, I don't want to go to any crossroads in Pitlochry. But
yeah.
Thankfully, I've never seen it. But if you go a little bit further out, you come to Killiecrankie, which has a famous battle from, I think, maybe 1689, where it's the first Jacobite rebellion, where Bonnie Dundee's Jacobite troops defeated the government troops. The thing that I loved about that, Killiecrankie had a visitor centre that had, is it called a diorama, when it's like a model with all the little figures of the battlefield. And I was, as a kid, I loved Mayerfix models, so I was fascinated by this model. I remember it. There was an Englishman had a Jacobite up on a pike, up in the air, and it just really, it was gory and it was violent. Violence, maybe not the right word, but it just captured my imagination. So that was Killiecrankie. And then I started to find out more about the history of the battle and the standing stone that I drove past to get to Killiecrankie. That's where Major Dundee was shot and mortally wounded. And then the old kirk that I would walk through when I was walking up Glenbanby, St. Bride's Kirk, and that's the kirk where Bonnie Dundee is buried. When you walk the Linnetumle, there's a slab, a big stone across the walk, and that's where one of the, I think it's Captain Balfour or something like that, where he was a government soldier, where he was shot and killed, and that's where he fell. So there's all of these little things that when you really start to pay attention to, like you said, you become laser focused in it, and you really start to get a real appreciation for the things that our ancestors went through, and the history that you're walking through at the time really brings it to life.
I mean, I adore books like this, Wayne, as well, because I always think I'm quite well versed, but I'm always very aware of, I know next to nothing really. and so when I discover new things, I'm like a little kid again, like you say. I'm still a teenager. But I spend a lot less time in the pub now. I'm just reading about ghosts and monsters instead, I think, and obviously going out for long walks with my dog and stuff. But I was very taken aback in this chapter where we're talking about some of the further flung hauntings away from Edinburgh, where you talk about this notorious house in Grand Tully, which was apparently the most haunted house in Scotland, but it seems to have completely fallen off the map, literally, because it seems as if it was notorious, but because of what happened and it's and how it fell into disrepair, people seem to have completely overlooked it these days. And it's weird how these places that you can find them if you look for them from a certain point, I think, that it seems that modern history has left them behind and then somebody will rediscover it. And this seems to be exactly that kind of case here.
Yeah, that's Balekin House. And Grantley, you fell into the trap that I fell into when I did the video on it. It's spelled Grantully, but apparently it's pronounced Grantley.
Right. Well, hey, so all knowledge, Wayne.
Yeah, one of the people that commented on the video pointed that out to me.
So politely, I'm sure.
Yeah, they were lovely about it. Yeah, Balekin House I knew about, but it kind of, I have a book called The Guinness Book of Ghosts and Spirits. And if you can get your hands on that, then it's fantastic. It's got stories from across the world. And it's got the story of Balekin House in it. But I hadn't really read that probably for about 10 years. And then I just thought, I'll pick it up. I think I was looking for The Exorcist. You know, there's a couple of accounts that are linked to The Exorcist, Eleanor Zuggin, things
yes,
like that.
Yes.
And then I stumbled upon Balekin House and just rejigged my memory. Balekin House, basically, like you say, it was notorious at the time. It was an early version of Borley Rectory, but in Scotland. It had investigations by the SPR. It had some incredible weird stories to it. It wasn't just one type of ghost, you know, it wasn't just an apparition of a white lady or anything like that. It had phantom dogs, it had poltergeist activity, it's got a ghost nun. It had all of these different things to it, and nobody knew about it. It just dropped off the radar. So it's stories like that that I just find fascinating. Something that was so well documented, it was in the newspapers, you know, not just in Scotland, it was in the newspapers right through the UK. I think it even made it to some of the world newspapers, but nobody knows about it anymore, and nobody talks about it, because it's been overtaken by, you know, in England you've got your 30 East Drives, in Scotland you've got Greyfriars, that kind of thing. These things just drop out the zeitgeist, and it's this kind of story that's really good to bring back into the public attention.
Well, yes, because I think one of the things, you sometimes read these stories and they seem to be just meandering along and telling us about a person. And here, I think it's Major Stewart, isn't it? Who's sort of attached to the house's more unusual history. And then obviously he dies and a relative takes charge of the property. And I'm reading it and I'm thinking, right. And when you read something, sometimes my brain will go, hang on a minute, let's read that again. And so for anybody who's yet to read the book, Wayne, whoever took over the house, was it his nephew or something, John, I believe he was called, he had all his dogs put down because he didn't want them in the house, which for me, I had to read it three or four times and think, at what point does somebody make that decision in good faith?
So Major Stuart had a long service history, particularly in India, and he built basically Balekin House, and he lived there. He was a bit of a recluse, but he did have one female servant who was a lot younger than him that he was very close to. She's kind of believed to have, I think this their official story kind of harks back to what we were talking about with cover-ups, was that she died in her sleep, but she really died in mysterious circumstances. And I think the finger of suspicion falls on Major Stuart as being responsible for her death. Mm. But he loved dogs, and he had a lot of dogs in the house. And like you say, he died, and then the nephew decided he didn't want the major's dogs, so he killed them all, which just beggars belief that you would do that. You know, there are plenty of other families around. It's the 19th century. People will have adopted dogs at the time. I think they were working dogs as well.
Yes.
So they would have benefited the family. Mm-hmm. And it's from that, that from the major's death, really, that the hauntings start. But when I was researching this, I remember being in my work and just making a throwaway comment that I couldn't pronounce Balekin House. I thought it was Balechin House, even though I'm Scottish and the CH is a K. But I mentioned that, and a friend that I was sat next to called Jess, she was like, oh, my granny used to work there. And I was like, oh, yeah. Our granny did work there. She didn't have any specific stories herself, but she went away and spoke to her granny, and she was like, oh, yeah, the dogs. And she was aware of the stories of the dogs, the ghost dogs that would haunt the place. You know, the people would hear growling and things like that. I think this is maybe some justice being served, but if memory serves, the nephew died in London.
Mm.
I can't remember if it was him or if it was somebody else associated with it, but that was at the same time that there was loud bangs heard within the Balekin House. So it was seen as that was signalling the death of this person who lived in the house. But it was really well investigated by the SPR. There was a woman called Ada Goodrich Freer who documented it all.
Mm.
And their findings were published, and I think you can still find them if you go into the SPR's archives.
Yeah.
They did a lot of seances, and during one of the seances, I think they were told to go up to this neighbouring glen, and when they did, that's when they saw the apparition of this nun. Which, you know, what's the link between the major and the nun? What's the link between the Balekin House and the nun? It's just a mind-boggling story. And it was, at that time, billed as the most haunted house in Scotland. But now, there's only a small part of it remains because there was a fire in 1963, which meant that they had to demolish the majority of the building. But there's a part of it that's still there. And I don't think there's anything that's carried on. Certainly my friend's gran lived there after she worked there after 1963, and she didn't report anything, so it seems like it's died down. But it's one of these ones that really was like a burning bright story that then just faded away and it's no longer spoken about.
Mm. I know when I've read about what went on and what people were reporting, the first thing that struck me was The Haunting, the film, Wayne, in regards to these enormous crashes and bangs that people could hear. And I think John and his family, weren't they so perturbed that he thought, bugger this, I'm going to build a new wing and live in that? And because you would think, well, clearly, if we're supposed to believe that these are rational people, that's an extremely irrational reaction to living in such a house, because you would think, I mean, obviously he's a very irrational person based on his behavior and his horrific treatment of his uncle's pets, for one thing. And you could probably suggest as well that event was the catalyst that kicked it all off, I think, because it doesn't seem like there was much reported before the major died, and then you've got this horrific event that goes on with the pet, and then all hell breaks loose after that. And like you say, I think he was run over, which I think is quite apt in London, John. Some would say it's poetic justice, I would suggest, Wayne. But it just shows you, though, that once again, here we have an extremely haunted house that suffers a strange fire. You could say that about Bolskin. You could say that about Borley Rectory. Both burnt down. Both were supposed to be the most haunted, some of the most haunted locations in Britain. And they both burnt down. And for it to essentially settle down over the last sort of 60 years into sort of what seems to be quite a pleasant place to live these days is quite surprising. It's almost as if sometimes you have hauntings that seem to have a time limit on them, Wayne, or that some would suggest that their work has been done and they no longer need to hang around anymore.
Yeah, it seems, you know, your classic apparition type hauntings, the residual types, are the ones that stick around. It's the ones that have that unusual element to it, like Balekin House. You know, it's there are multiple different types of phenomena happening there. Bangs, poltergeist activity, apparitions, all sorts. They're the kind that kind of, like I said earlier, burn bright and then just die out. I do know of the Parliament Square haunting that I'm currently researching that is ongoing. It's a little bit hearsay, but it's a property in quite an affluent area of Edinburgh, central Edinburgh, that a couple of people moved into in the early 2000s, and they had some really strange events happening there. And they ended up fleeing the property, basically. There's two people. One of them was a BBC journalist who lived in the flat opposite the person who submitted the story, and she's corroborated it. But they're still friends with people who work in the area, and the properties went up for sale and they couldn't sell it. It went for let, and it's always up for let, which is similar to, I don't know if you know the story of Learmonth Gardens with the Seton family stealing the bone from ancient Egypt.
Oh, yes.
That's a fantastic story. Peter Underwood's believes that to be the proof of a haunting. He thinks it's the most, we thought it was the most convincing haunting that he's ever encountered.
Yeah.
That's another property where it's a townhouse. I think it's on 3 or 4 levels. It's been split into different flats now, as is the way with things, but there's always a property that's for sale or for let in there. It's like people don't stay. These are a couple of stories that kind of contradict what I said earlier. That's the really unusual types that seem to burn bright and then die away, whereas the more traditional romantic lady in white or the lady in black seem to carry on for hundreds of years potentially.
Yeah, I mean, there are some of these strange stories. I mean, the one about the Isle of Skye, about the camper having the shock of his life, is one I had read, and I'm not sure where I read it, but it was quite a while ago. But it is one of those that you will occasionally stumble across these stories of people who seem to, almost as if they've walked into the past and find themselves in some kind of clan skirmish or a Highlander battle. And they're like, what the hell is going on? And this is the Skye one. I always thought it was one of the most well-reported. But after reading your book, I was looking about it, and it seems to be one of those, once again. I think because it's of where it is, a lot of people lose focus on it because it's not happening in Edinburgh or Glasgow or near Loch Ness, and therefore, for some people, well, that's all there is to Scotland, isn't it?
Yeah, I do like the meme that somebody's drawn a map of Scotland, and it's basically Edinburgh and then the road to Skye. Skye, it cracks me up. There's so much to Scotland, you know, Glasgow, Stirling. So many places that you could stop off on the way. But yes, Skye is, you know, if you live on Skye, they'll tell you that they're overloaded with tourists. I think people go to there for the natural beauty of the area. It's a stunning place. I don't know if you've ever been there, Paul, but if you get an opportunity, then I would definitely head to Skye. I prefer Lewis and Harris, but that's just my personal preference. Skye's lovely. So people aren't really going for like the ghost stories, they're going for the natural aspects and maybe a little bit of the folklore, because Skye's full of folklore, lots of stories of fairies and things like that. You've got the fairy glens, the fairy pool. So you do have that kind of more folklorish aspect to it, but it also is a very haunted place. I've got a good friend from Skye called John who I lived with in the mid-90s, and he used to tell me stories that they would... He lived in Dunvegan, and he worked in Dunvegan Castle, which is notoriously haunted. And they would walk across the moors at night, and they'd see effectively like will-o'-the-wisp flitting in between the trees and or the vegetation and things like that. And he's also had experiences where this event that you mentioned, which is a place called Sleagakin, and it's the Phantom Highlanders, I think is the story that you're referencing, which was reported by Sir Patrick Skipworth. Now, if memory serves, he was quite an experienced outdoorsman. He was also, I think he did a wee bit of acting, and he was a geologist, if memory serves. He camped there in the 1960s with one of his friends, and they camped in, is it Corrie Fee Glen? Somewhere in Sligachan anyway. I can't quite remember the name of it. And around about midnight, he got out of his tent, and he basically witnessed, like you said, a vision from days gone by. He saw lots of men in Highland attire kind of crawling their way through the heather up the side of a hill, not making any sound, and then they disappeared. He called out his friend from his tent, and they both watched this event happening, which is just, it's just crazy. It's like a time slip, as you said. But if you look a wee bit more into the history of Sligachan, there's also the ghost car. Now, this is a fascinating story. I actually found a video of this on YouTube, and if you get a chance to look for it, look for it, because they're talking to people who've lived in Skye all their life, and their accent is just wonderful. It's like they're singing the story to you. I could listen to them all day.
Beautiful.
But I think it's a 1934 Austin car is seen basically flying about these country roads at breakneck speeds, and people will pull over to let the car pass, and it doesn't appear. It gets lost behind a bush, that kind of thing. But again, I spoke to my friend John, and he said, yes, that's, everybody talks about that on the island, but nobody talks about that on the mainland, because it's not an Edinburgh-based story. It's not Glam's Castle or anything like that. It's not one of the really famous ones. And he had his own experience there. He was driving with his girlfriend along the road at Sligachan, and they saw a girl at the side of the road. I think he'd mentioned that she was in kind of camelish coloured clothes, like a Hessian sack type thing. And they thought that she wanted a lift, and as they drove past her, they looked in the mirrors and she was gone, but they were both adamant that they'd seen her when she drove past. So there's something about that area of Sligachan, that road in particular, that has clung on to some sort of energy, and there's something reliving or replaying itself there.
I always find ghost car stories fascinating, Wayne, because it kind of takes ghosts to a different level, because people often will say, oh well, it ghosts are people or animals, and then you will stumble across these stories like this ghost car, where people can tell you exactly the type of car it is, and in this day and age that's going to be extremely distinctive anyway. You know, even cars from the 1970s. I mean, there's a guy around the corner who's got a Ford Cortina outside his house from about 1976. And it always makes me smile, Wayne, when I walk past. It's a Ford Cortina. It's not like it's a Ferrari or a Porsche, you know. But that always reminds me of being a kid, because my granddad had a Ford Cortina. It's one of the first cars I ever drove about in as a child. And so when you have these stories where they've got specific makes and models that are unique to the sighting in the modern era. I mean, even if you started seeing this in the 50s and 60s, you would think this is some kind of relic, really, rather than which local hermit may have got their hands on a 1936 Austin. And I just love them, because you think, well, how on earth have we got a ghost car going on? Because cars don't have souls, do they?
Yeah, if you believe in the stone tape type theory, then what event is it replaying? Well, you know, the islanders talk of the reason for the haunting was there was, I think it was a priest was driving the car onto a ferry, and something happened that the accelerator pedal stuck, or he must have put his foot down too hard, and it caused the car to burst through the ferry doors at the other end of the pier and plunged into the water. And he died, and there were two women and a young child that were with him, and nobody survived that. And that's the catalyst that people talk about for this haunting. But why would it be on this stretch of road, and why wouldn't it be at the place that the accident happened? Such a strange story, but I love it. Like you know, who doesn't love a ghost car zooming around a dark country road on the Isle of Skye? It's a great story.
Absolutely. It's up there with the possessed Ford Capri for me, I think. From the south coast in the 90s, which was hilarious, and just a very strange, especially when he said, yeah, and it eats all my tapes. Oh, that's probably just a crap tape deck, or you've got really rubbish taste in music, and it doing us all a favor, perhaps. Who knows? I mean, before I let you go, Wayne, is there one story that you think is incredible and baffling that more people don't know about?
I think I referenced it earlier. It's the Blackett Place haunting. That one, I knew nothing about that until 2 years ago. And it's a book by, I think it's Alan Murdy or Ron Halliday.
Mm.
And it's basically just a paragraph in the book about a Victorian property where apparitions were spotted. And I didn't really take any heed of it. It's just one of these run-of-the-mill stories. But then I thought I'd dig into it a wee bit more. And it's such... it's another one that's a strange story. And it's got lovely links to sort of famous Edinburghers. I mentioned Dr. Knox. He lived in Blackett Place. It's got links to Dr. Bell, who was the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes. He lived on Blackett Place as well. So, you know, there's that history aspect too also. But the story is more than just the odd apparition of a woman in white, although she features a lot in it. It was a Greek family moved in. The names of them aren't mentioned in the accounts that I can find, but we have been able to dig up a little bit more information on it, and we found a couple of names. Basically, the woman that lived in the property before them is believed to have died in her bath. I think she drowned in her bath, and they moved in afterwards. And that's when things start to get really weird. It's quite a big property. If you know this area, it's up beside the Commonwealth Pool. And the properties there are Victorian Georgian style, big houses, impressive houses. And I think it's one of two houses, and both of them look like they're haunted houses, which just makes it an even better story for my liking. But there was three daughters that lived in the house along with the mother, and they had a schoolroom. And one of the daughters seemed to have it worse than others. She would see the ghosts, and she could kind of black out at times. There was one occasion where she felt something on the back of her head, and I think she blacked out. But she would see this woman dressed in a white dress. I think she had a veil over her head. She would leave the schoolroom, or she'd be seen walking up the stairs and seen standing at the top of the stairs looking down at them. All three of the daughters saw this. The servant saw the woman as well. So it feels at this place, it's just a traditional woman in white ghost story, but she's seen on regular occasions constantly, to the point that the family just now kind of accept that this is part of the house. I think it's the mother who was in possibly the study, was sat in the room on her own, and the door to the study opened, and a man's face appeared from the side of the door, and she described him as kind of devilish looking with yellow skin, which is quite an horrific kind of thought. You know, there's an intruder in your house, and not only that, he's yellow, not normal. So yeah, that's a story that when I read it, I found the letters from the sisters to the Society for Psychical Research, and I was reading them. You know, it's written in Victorian language, so it's quite hard for the 21st century brain to make it flow the way that we normally would.
Mm.
But the way that they talk about it, so matter of fact, I was just blown away by the story, and it's now become my favourite Edinburgh story. It's a fascinating story.
Fabulous. Well, Wayne, thank you so much for being such an eloquent and informative guide to some of your favourite cases and locations in and around Edinburgh and beyond. Where can everybody get hold of your latest book and follow your incredible YouTube channel, which dives into some wonderful stories from all over your glorious home country?
Thank you, Paul. So you can find the book on Amazon. We sell through Beyond the Fray Publishing, wonderful bunch of people. But you'll find it on Amazon, or you can find a link to it on my website, which is just erieedinburgh.com. And the YouTube channel, as you said, is Erie Edinburgh. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, or X, if you call it X. Just look for Erie Edinburgh.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links, as always, in the show notes for everybody. And once again, thank you for joining me for the first time. Thank you for your support of me and the show. It's always humbling to speak to somebody who enjoys what I do. It makes it all worthwhile, Wayne. And I wish and look forward to the following volumes, because I hope this will be the first of a series, and you will continue to enthrall us with more lost ghost stories.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually writing the follow-up book, which will be moving south of the border to England. So I've got a good few stories on the go just now, but if anybody has any stories that aren't really spoken about or known about, then please do get in touch with me.
Thank you again, Wayne. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul.